there's nothing really you can do to prepare yourself for being president on that first day. They bring you into the Oval Office and then everybody leaves and you're standing there thinking, oh man, now what? Because suddenly this immense responsibility falls on your shoulders and you're just standing there on the thin, thin ice of history where one misstep and you fall through.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Terry Sullivan is a director of the White House Transition Project, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that provides information to new White House staff about their individual offices, thereby streamlining the process of transition from one administration to the next. It's run by scholars who study the U.S. presidency. We had a timely conversation about the ongoing transition from Trump to Biden, including how it compares to previous presidential transitions. We also talked about the Transition Project itself, what information it manages, and how it's used by presidential staffers. So first, our sponsor, and then my interview with Terry Sullivan and the White House Transition Project.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Terry Sullivan. I'm the executive director of the White House Transition Project. I'm a professor emeritus from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in political science. I'm a PhD scholar who focuses on presidential leadership, coalition formation, and presidential appointments.
Were you the founder of the White House Transition Project?
I'm a co-founder. There are two of us, Martha Kumar, who is a retired academic from Towson University, is the other co-founder. And it was really a group project started in 1996. A bunch of presidential scholars thought we could help new administrations learn the ropes, find out what they should know before they start, find out what others have wished they had known after taking office. So we created this program interviewing people who had held high-level positions, what are called assistants to the president, in previous White Houses, starting with Nixon, and working forward, about how they did their job, what they wished they had known when they took it, what they were glad to know in retrospect, how they organized their office, how their day went, when was it time for them to leave, what mistakes did they make, what did they do right, etc.
Sounds like a very worthy project. Tell me a little more about that founding. Like, how did that all come together?
Coming up on the end of the Clinton administration, we knew that the National Archives used to do what were called exit interviews with members of the White House as they left. They would submit to an hour-long interview about working in the White House. And that program had been canceled for budget reasons. We thought that was unfortunate. But we also had some dissatisfaction with the kinds of questions that were asked to people. Typically, the interviews were conducted by historians, and they were more interested in the details of how this person that they were interviewing got to know the president. What did they think were the personal qualities of the president? Sort of the history of specific events that happened during an administration that they might be involved in. We thought that these exit interviews should be more about how the offices functioned in the White House. We didn't really care when was the first time somebody met the guy who would later someday become president. We were really more interested in the questions that I'd mentioned before, in particular, how the office ran. One of the things that we discovered when we were talking to people like James Baker III about his role as chief of staff, one of the things we discovered was that these guys, once they worked in the White House, the balance between their partisan interests and their interests in the country as a whole shifted towards the latter. They saw more reason to help their successors than they saw to not help. And the problem for them was these partisans were perfectly happy to provide this information, but they really didn't want to have others in their party know that they were doing it. So they were looking for what I called somebody to launder their information. And we just happened to come along at the right time and provided this sort of academic environment in which they could talk to us, knowing that we were going to pass this information on to their successors. And that's what we did. We build up briefing books about these various offices in the White House. The briefing books are basically concatenating the information that's provided by these people who have done these jobs before. We don't act as scholars telling them how to do their job. We act as historians of operations telling successors what their predecessors thought they should need to know.
To what extent did those successors take advantage of the information? I imagine if you're coming into one of these positions, you're infinitely busy. How would they find the time for this, or to what extent do you know that they did?
Yeah, so we do know they did. Partly the reason we know they did is because they tell us. Often we come back and interview them. Obviously, we interview them for the next round, but we also have found that in the past, the fact that we provide this service, it's nonpartisan, it's very circumspect. They discover that we are a resource that they can come to talk about things that they don't understand. And when they do that, they also say, oh, well, you know, I read your briefing book and I really didn't know anything about the job, and I learned what I needed to know from reading your briefing book. Also, we get a lot of information. I mean, we've had interactions with former presidents. We have a very nice letter from George W. Bush thanking us for all of our help, both in 2001 and in 2009. So we know they've used it. We also know because they come to us and ask us to help solve some problems. For example, one of the things we did in 2000 during the campaign was we brought together all of the former White House chiefs of staff to talk about what it was like to be chief of staff. And one of the things that they asked us to do was to give Andy Card, who was going to be George W.'s chief of staff, to give Andy Card an opportunity to answer the same sort of questions based on his experience, because he was one of the most experienced people who had ever been White House chief of staff. He'd been deputy, been commerce secretary, so he'd been in a lot of administrations. So I went to interview him in December of 2001 about his first 100 days experience, and also to allow him to answer the same questions that the former chiefs had been asked. And one of the things he asked us to do an analysis of meetings taking place in the Oval Office versus meetings taking place in the Roosevelt Room, which is right across the hall from the Oval Office, because they were interested in their experience that similar meetings in the Roosevelt Room went faster than similar meetings in the Oval Office. We were happy to do that kind of analysis. It's a kind of thing that takes a lot of resources that we had, because there are a large number of groups, Secret Service, the residential staff, the White House operators, the appointment staff in the anteroom to the Oval Office. All of these groups keep logs of what the president's doing, who he's talking to on the phone, who he's in meetings with. And these logs are essentially minute by minute. And then once a week, the National Archives has a records unit that takes all of these logs and builds something called the President's Daily Diary, which is a composite of what the president's doing, who he's seeing, where he is, et cetera. And then they store these in the various presidential libraries. And it's a wonderful resource, but it's also extremely difficult data to come by and analyze. And so this is one of the projects that the White House Transition Project has invested in over the last 20 years, is looking at these daily diaries, coding them, building up a big database on what is the president does all day, who does the president see, what are they engaged in, and how do the various responsibilities the president has day in and day out trade off against the other responsibilities. So we could answer the question, are similar meetings more efficiently done in the Roosevelt Room versus the Oval Office? And so that's the kind of thing that happens. And in the process of that, answering those questions, we have this interaction with White House staff, and they, you know, tell us how much they valued our assistance.
Can you describe what has been different between a standard transition pre-Trump and then the two transitions, one sort of in progress with Trump now?
Transitions basically vary by how far in advance did the presidential campaign begin working on them. So the earlier a team can start learning what it needs to know in a presidential transition, the better off that transition goes. Some presidential candidates like Bill Clinton and John McCain don't want to spend any time having their staff think about the transition planning because they're afraid that somehow that will look presumptive. People campaigning for the presidency are very nervous. They don't know what's going to blow up in their faces. Some are less risk averse, like Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush, and they start transition planning very early. George W. started transition planning months before he even announced he was running for president. He had a group completely committed to doing nothing but what do we do after we win? They had nothing to do. They were associated with the campaign, but they had nothing to do with the campaign. Same thing with Reagan. Same thing with Obama. Other candidates don't do as much. The teams that don't spend a lot of time are overwhelmed by the demands that a presidency brings. One of the things that often happens, even with the best of people who are planning for a transition, they often imagine that the White House is just sort of a grander version of what they've already done. So we've had somebody characterize it as, we're just sending the best hitter on our AAA ball club up to the major league team. And if you know anything about baseball, you know that the difference between a fastball in the major leagues and a fastball in the AAA is, you know, 4 or 5 miles an hour. That's not an insignificant difference in baseball, but it's not the difference between, say, being governor of the second largest state in the union and being president. For example, George W. Bush, as governor of Texas, the second largest state in the union in terms of population, managed to appoint, you know, 400 or 500 people to his administration. They maintained a database, an HR database of about 15,000 resumes. It took them 4 years to gather those 15,000 resumes, and they got 15,000 resumes in the 24 hours after the election.
Huge jump in scale and couple orders of magnitude, not to mention the difference between commanding armed forces and National Guard.
And managing a global economy.
Yeah.
And a global diplomatic presence. It's exactly 15 times larger. The fastball in the AAA ball club is 90 miles an hour, and the fastball in the major leagues is 1,200 miles an hour.
It's very hard to hit.
Very hard to even see, since it breaks the sound barrier twice before it gets to home plate. That's a surprise to them. Karl Rove, for example, often touted as a great political mind, during the summer before the election, put together a research team that identified what other presidents had done all day so he could schedule out the first 2 weeks of George Bush's time in the White House, when they won. And he let us look at that data, and it turned out that they underestimated what previous presidents had done because they were using public records rather than the president's daily diary, like we did. So we had something to compare what the presidents actually did to what they thought they had done. And they were often hundreds of times off, underestimating what presidents were doing. So when they came into office, even though they had spent a lot of time preparing, they were nevertheless unprepared for the kinds of demands they were getting. Karl Rove said it was something like being a fire hydrant in a world of dogs.
Very quotable.
Also, it was the frustration of thinking that being governor of Texas and spending all this time preparing was going to get them completely ready for this tidal wave that falls down on the president. There just really isn't anything in the world like being president. The management team of Walmart, the largest employer in the country, there are several cabinet agencies that are multiple times larger than Walmart in terms of employees and multiple times larger in budget than the revenues of a Walmart. President Obama in 2016 said, you know, there's nothing really you can do to prepare yourself for being president on that first day. They bring you into the Oval Office and then everybody leaves and you're standing there thinking, oh man, now what? Because suddenly this immense responsibility falls on your shoulders and you're just standing there on the thin, thin ice of history where one misstep and you fall through.
So how did you find the difference between pre-Trump transitions and the two Trump transitions?
The Trump for President campaign selected Governor Christie of New Jersey, and he brought in a team to actually prepare for the transition, and they spent the whole summer working. So that's about the median for presidential preparations, campaign preparations, to start around May and get serious about it leading up to the election. And unfortunately, President Trump, and we're not sure yet who all was involved in this, but all those people were fired and all their plans were thrown out on the Saturday after the election on Tuesday. That was an absolute disaster for the president. It meant he never got his appointments process in gear. They really weren't able to build an agenda, a policy agenda. And to this day, they've really been way behind other presidents in terms of staffing up the national government. They never really got the American government up and running. By the end of their first year, the Reagan experience in appointing people had already lapped Trump's experience by a year. So Trump was already a year behind where President Reagan was in terms of nominating and getting people confirmed and put in place. And Obama and Clinton were a month off from lapping him. His administration did half as well in getting the national government stood up And of course, they really didn't have a policy agenda. They passed this massive tax cut. If you can't get your own majority in Congress to give money back to constituents.
What about in terms of kind of learning from what went before? Did you find that Trump appointees went to your transition project? Did they take advantage of it?
Well, the Christie people certainly did. People, as they got appointed to positions in the White House, started looking around for resources. Yes, once they got the job, they were scared. But, you know, most of Trump's people weren't appointed until January of 2017. You know, that's already behind the eight ball. They're reading our briefing books and learning how to organize their offices about 3 months too late, 2 months too late anyway. So they are trying to drink from the fire hose at the same time they're trying to fight the fire hose back with a trash can lid. It's just not a good experience.
You mentioned that James Baker found this transition from being more of a partisan to concern for the country. Do you see that transition in the Trump White House as they are potentially likely outgoing?
Yeah. So, yes, there are people in the Trump White House who have worked to organize the transition, but there's really nothing they can do when the guy at the top won't let them proceed. So there are some talented people in the White House Chief of Staff's office who have been working all along with the transition, preparing for the transition, because there are statutes that govern what the White House has to do in certain timeframes. And there have been people in the Trump White House who have been carrying out the law.
What do you see in terms of the Biden team as it's starting to be formed? How are they doing so far?
Actually, I spent the morning filling in statistics on how quickly, though. They're right down the middle of where they should be by comparison with their predecessors in terms of when do you appoint a White House Chief of Staff, when do you announce members of the cabinet, stuff like that. They're right down the middle so far. So they're doing about as well as previous administrations have done. Ron Klain, very talented, very experienced person, is the White House Chief of Staff. That's just the kind of guy you need in these circumstances. And my expectation is that they will start. President-elect Biden has been there, done that, which is unusual for a president-elect. So he's been on the inside of a transition. He's been on the inside of a transition when things were not in good shape. So I fully expect they'll be prepared and they'll be ready to roll when the time comes.
I mean, you must be getting this question constantly these days. What consequence do you think there is to the incoming administration to have the previous president so recalcitrant about accepting his defeat?
Yeah. So we know, for example, that the 9/11 Commission particularly highlighted the challenge in the Supreme Court and the delay that that caused as a contributor to our being less prepared when 9/11 happened. Now, that's different from this. There was a legitimate question in 2000 as to who was elected president. There's no question about that now. I fully expect that the Biden team is rolling itself forward in the appointments process. The other thing that happens with transitions is coming to grips with the whole idea of what it's like. And the reality is the outside world likes to think of the president as doing one thing a day, but presidents do dozens and dozens and dozens of major things every day. And so while it's easier for people to get a grasp on one thing at a time. Presidents work in multiple dimensions all the time. I don't know if you've ever seen the West Wing TV show, but the president is always saying in that show, what's next? Because that's really what it's like to be president. It's not, what are you doing now? It's, what's next? You know, the Congress is many, many hundreds of people working who could work literally around the clock. The presidency is one guy, and that one guy has to sleep.
I mean, you've looked at the way people, presidents, have spent their time in this,
yeah,
in this careful detail. Was Trump different in how he spent his time than average presidents?
Yeah. So one thing is, we won't really know the answer to that question. The president's daily diary, which is itself a national secret, is made available only after 12 years from leaving office. So we won't know for 12 years what Trump did all day. But we do know this from looking at presidents' daily diaries from Eisenhower all the way through George W. Bush, who was the last president whose diary is available yet. There are some very standard trade-offs that happen in the president's work. So when a president has a presidential press conference, he can't be taking a national security briefing at the same time. That's just a reality of being president. The Congress can do many things at once, but the president can only do one thing at a time. And you can't just make the president's day longer and longer and longer to accommodate all the things that the president needs to do. Henry Kissinger used to say, the idea that the president deals with crises is kind of mundane. The president deals with crises that are on fire. So,
well, you know, on the other hand, the president has an awful lot of lieutenants that are working in parallel, cabinet, and they are in a certain way able to have things going on many fronts.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons they can have things going on many fronts. But the constitutional reality is there is a whole range, 24 hours worth of things that are above every one of those guys' pay grades that only the president can do. That's one of the challenges of running a White House is, how do you make decisions among things that only the president can do, and all of them are demanding, and all of them sum to more hours in the day than there are, and the president's got to sleep. But there are a few things where the president's time, if you're going to increase his time on X, you're going to take that time directly from Y. And those are the following. The president increases his time on national security, commander-in-chief and chief diplomat, at the expense of communicating with the public and vice versa. So the more time the president spends communicating with the public, the less time there is in the day for the president to spend on diplomacy and national security. So we know that because Trump spends hours a day on communication, he has been spending way less time on national security. So he spends way much more time doing communications with the public than any other president by far. And there's a direct trade-off between how much time he spends on communications and how much time presidents spend on national security. That's a common trade-off across all administrations dating back to the Eisenhower administration.
One of the observations that's been out in the press recently, there's a notion that the Trump administration is actually working to sabotage the incoming administration in a variety of ways. Does that seem different in order than previous, or is it fairly similar?
It's different by magnitudes, but it's not completely out of unheard of. And it's often the case that presidents who are running for re-election, as opposed to presidents who know they are done, so the difference between George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush is that when he was working on the transition to Obama, he knew he was done. George H.W. Bush had a transition to Bill Clinton that was, in a way, a surprise because he lost re-election. So transitions of presidents who have lost re-election are going to be more at variance. They're going to be less prepared. The transition out is going to be less prepared, partly because candidates and the people who work for those candidates don't like the idea that they're planning on losing, and they feel uncomfortable about it, and so they're not prepared for it. A president who knows he's going out, like George W. Bush did in 2008, knows that one of the things that is common about their administration is that executive orders and administrative regulations are an ongoing process. It takes a while for an EPA regulation to get posted and public comment and all that sort of stuff before it becomes law-like. An ongoing administration is constantly in the process of producing regulations. An outgoing administration that knows it's going to be leaving office at time fixed will typically say to issue an executive, an administrative memorandum in May of the election year that says, I want everybody in the executive branch to finalize whatever regulations they're going to have by August 1st, for example. So that there is nothing that comes to fruition in the early part of the new administration. A team that thinks it's going to stay in office is still doing regulations right up and into the fall. And those regulations then turn out to be exploding cigars for the new administration. An example, Bill Clinton was absolutely convinced that Al Gore was going to be his successor, issued a regulation through the EPA that reduced the amount of arsenic that was allowed in water, in drinking water. And that regulation came into effect in February, and they fully expected it was going to be on Al Gore's watch. And so it was going to be consistent with what Al Gore, you know, wanted to have happen. As it turned out, Al Gore lost, and George W. Bush got saddled with this EPA regulation that reduced the amount of arsenic. Well, arsenic naturally occurs in water, in all groundwater in the United States, everywhere. And so his EPA director canceled that regulation at the last minute, and it made it look like George W. Bush was allowing more arsenic in the water. And so for a couple of weeks, that was the news, is how George W. Bush was allowing more arsenic in America's water, when that really wasn't the intent of the regulation, but it was what happened. Now, that's a function of the transition out not being well organized. So some of what's going to happen is because Trump is not very competent as a president, as administrator. He's surrounded by people who are not very competent. And so there's going to be lots of this sort of stuff that falls between the cracks. Then there are acts that the president is taking which are meant to mess things up. The federal budget is about to run out, December 11th, I think. We could have an actual government shutdown in the middle of the presidential transition. Unemployment compensation has not been reauthorized, and so it's going to run out the end of December. And you don't see the president working to get that done.
Isn't there something also with evictions coming up?
All of these things. Yes, all of these things. The CDC order that prevents evictions is going to run out. You know, basically the president's given up on COVID. Even if things were to go okie dokie for the next 6 weeks, President Biden is going to take the oath of office in the midst of the equivalent of World War II and the Great Depression at the same time. That really is a disaster. And whether the president intends it or not, he's certainly not doing anything to ameliorate it, the possibility of that happening. Now, I don't believe the president intends this, but he is doing his best to become the next Hoover in American history. And that leaves Joe Biden to be the next FDR in American history. And these are not things that one wants for oneself as a president or one wants for one's successor as a president.
Well, one of the wrinkles to the situation is that President Trump seems to be seriously contemplating a comeback 4 years from now and seems to think that anything that sabotages Biden will redound to his benefit down the line. Do you see that playing into his calculations?
Well, okay. So if you were Herbert Hoover, would you want Franklin Roosevelt to have a Great Depression to rescue America from?
Well, I don't think Trump is thinking about it that way. I think he's thinking, you know, yeah, I understand your point. I think Trump would imagine that he's been painting a picture of his success and a vaccine coming and the stock market still up. And then this depression lands, you know, by analog on Biden and Biden becomes Hoover.
No, but Biden isn't.
But you understand that Trump thinks he can create his own reality, it seems.
Yes. And I think that's and that's certainly a possibility, right? But the reality, I don't know how long propaganda can overcome dire circumstances. 1984 was a work of fiction. You can't just keep telling people something that's false and they believe it.
I hope you're right about that, but there seems to be an awful lot of people absorbing fairly false narratives right now.
Yes, but part of that's because the president of the United States has the largest microphone in the global communications network. Take that microphone away from him and he'll only have his own personal propaganda machine.
You're a longtime student of presidential leadership, and one wants to see the presidency done well by either party. You run a nonpartisan organization. How does that, you know, that position that you and your enterprise have affect how you can communicate these sort of things about something that's not being done well by the current incumbent?
Mostly we communicate that in private. When they come and ask, they've got to ask. We try not to become public figures in this sort of thing. For example, the very thing we're talking about right now, the very thing that we're doing right now, is we spend a lot of time worrying about not taking a partisan position, but helping the general public understand the process and what the advantages and disadvantages are, what the opportunities are, and how to achieve those opportunities.
Can you tell me a little more about the transition project itself? Like, how big is this? How many people work there? How are you funded? What's it like to run it?
This is a collection of scholars, all of whom are professionally focused on the presidency. So we have... Sometimes we manage to do our work on our own budgets, on our own academic time. Sometimes we're funded by foundations. For example, our first foray into this starting in 1997 was funded by the Pew Charitable Trust. And we've been funded by a private foundation called the Moody Foundation of Galveston, Texas. But there have been lots of times, and this is one of them, when we've had no funding at all from foundations, and we're just doing it because this is what we do.
Have you worked to get that, or are you happy with the situation?
We maintain big databases, and they're hard to maintain without funding. We're not happy with the fact that we've been unable to get the attention of some foundations this last cycle, which started 2 years ago. But it's been par for the course. The Pew Charitable Trust, for example, believed that they had a role to play in helping the presidential transition. They saw it as a need and they went out looking for somebody and they found us. We were looking for them and we found them. But lots of foundations think they understand how American public policy gets made and they have their own ideas about what's critical and what they can and can't do. And they don't realize that in that ignorance that there is this project which they could put very little money in and it would have a huge impact on the kind of policymaking that they're actually concerned about. And then there are a lot of foundations now that believe that even though they are getting special treatment in the federal tax code as 501c3 nonprofits, that they don't really need to open themselves up to cold calls by the general public, that they only fund what they are interested in funding and what they know about. And because we try to fly under the radar in a lot of ways, they just don't see us, which is unfortunate. And then, frankly, what has happened is this last cycle, we got caught by COVID. You know, all the foundations closed down and everybody went home.
Terry, is there a question that I didn't ask you about this transition or your work that you'd like to answer?
One thing is, what's the biggest hurdle to having a good transition?
What is the biggest hurdle?
Yeah, the biggest hurdle is this idea that whatever it is your guy has done before that makes him eligible to run for president is enough experience to make him or her a successful president. You really want them to just turn a key and have this long-standing set of plans click into place and start running, because it's way bigger than 70 days can contain. And if you haven't been prepared to do what you need to do long before election day, you are in real trouble. And the country's in real trouble.
I guess if you were a real estate developer and you had not a lot of experience in government, you might even want to be more careful about that transition.
Yeah, but you know what happens is business people are often impressed with their own capacities. And they really are the worst at this sort of thing because they really don't have any experience in national affairs. You know, one of the things I'm very optimistic about is that Joe Biden is the best prepared legislative leader that we have had as president since Lyndon Johnson. That's just a profoundly important skill when it comes to making American public policy, because the American constitutional system is built on getting along. The great legislator Sam Rayburn used to say that the secret to politics in Congress was if you wanted to get along, you had to go along. But that's a recommendation that is in the DNA of the constitutional system. It's in Madison's Federalist Number 10, the most famous Federalist paper explaining the Constitution. How do we prevent the country from running amok on the grounds of factional disunity? What one group of people cares about the most is not what another group cares about the most. And so accommodation and learning to sacrifice what we don't care about in order to get what we do care about is critical to success in the constitutional system as it was imagined. And that is the business of legislators. That is the life of legislators. Learning about the desires of others and figuring out a way to get along with one another and accommodate. And this tribalism and conflict that we've had recently is profoundly unconstitutional and un-American. And so Joe Biden has the best pedigree that we could possibly imagine for getting us out of all this stuff that we don't like, both in terms of politics and economy and health, because they all require learning to get along and accommodate. And I just think he's really prepared for that.
It will be fascinating to see how he copes with multiple crises and a outgoing president who may be campaigning the entire time. I wish for my country for his success. I think you're right that he's well prepared. We'll see if history can be made to go the right direction.
But if you think about it, this is exactly what makes politicians go. The great presidents are the ones who rescue America from bad times. Civil war, depression, global conflict. These are exactly the circumstances that these guys get up every day and drag themselves into the office for.
This is his moment and his opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah.
Terry, I really appreciate you taking the time. It was an honor to talk to you. Anything else you want to say?
Nope.
Okay. That was Terry Sullivan. Terry is at WhiteHouseTransitionProject.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.